Blog Talk Radio.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts. You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. We're having some minor technical difficulties in regards to where you can be able to tune in and hear Alan and myself in our discussion, but hopefully we'll get that taken care of. Today we're discussing the growing gap between the two corporate parties and working people. And Alan, once again, thank you for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
Alan, last week we were sort of taking on many of this and when we see about the representation that we have in this country, is the worst it's been within the last 200 years of this government. People, they believe that they have a democracy, but we have anything but a democracy. The leaders that we have in government now, they are oligarchs representing the most elite in our society, representing Wall Street, big corporations, multinational corporations. So, but people still have the illusion that they have a democratically elected government to represent their interests. To point out is when originally when this country was founded, you had representation in the House of Representatives for every representative. They represented 60,000 individuals. Now every representative represents somewhere a million. It's closer to 65. I believe it's close to. It's well over 500,000 people representing each district. But anyway, Alan, the point is the breakdown of representation is no longer there in government. But the intentions were never to have representation or to have a democratic elected government. It's tough for you to just,
Stuart, you're breaking up badly.
Can you hear me now, Alan?
I couldn't hear about the last 30 seconds.
Okay, some of the things I like to share
I can't hear you at all. I can't hear you. Alan, can you?
No, I can't hear Stuart at all right now.
No.
Okay, I still hear.
You're back.
Okay. Much of the representation that we have in Congress is geared toward representing the interests of Wall Street. Alan, where have we seen the shift within the last 25 years where it's become so obvious that the representation is lost there in Congress?
Well, I think the main shift has come during the Reagan years, and it's gotten worse as the years go by. Obviously, under George Bush, we had terrible representation, and now under Obama, it's even worse. Wall Street rules. I don't think anybody would deny that it's Wall Street ruling this country very openly right now. And there are several issues where this is, very obvious in my opinion, and I think in the opinions of most of the American people, on the issue of peace and war and whether or not we should be spending and using the resources of this country to continue these dirty imperialist wars or using those funds to provide for human needs like care, education, to take care of our infrastructure, our entire system of roads and highways is just crumbling. It's going to take years to fix this infrastructure. We have a country where Wall Street rules so thoroughly. The Supreme Court ruling with Citizens United, I mean, this in itself shows the rule of Wall Street, the very open rule of Wall Street. And then we have this issue of the minimum wage that has surfaced where, you know, millions of people across this country are demanding real living wages. And neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are willing to even consider that people have the right to real living wages and a decent standard of living in this country. So I think this, more than probably any other issue, shows what's wrong in this country and shows that it's Wall Street that's ruling through its two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. Are we still online?
Yeah, but I can't hear Stuart.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, I have to apologize for it. I have a very bad connection today. What was the last thing that you were saying, Alan?
I was saying that I think that it's this issue of peace and war and the issue of the minimum wage that more than any other issue show that we have Wall Street in complete control in this country and that the American people, especially the working people, have no representation at all in the halls of Congress. Even at the state level, when we go down to the city and county levels, working people have very, very little representation anymore in this country. Even you can look at the township level, and it's almost impossible for a working person to get elected to public office in this country anymore. Just a congressional seat costs millions of dollars to buy, and it's going to take tremendous organization on the part of working people to change this. We've got to break free from this two-party trap.
Well, what is happening, Alan, you see that the big corporations are spending, they are spending millions and millions of dollars even for many of the state campaigns now, and we can see that on a national level, buying public offices has gone up to the point where it's in the billions of dollars. Alan, when you see corporations investing that kind of money to have representation, I mean, isn't it what we see today, they're buying the politics of this country?
Well, of course, that's the reason they spend that much money. Nobody would spend that much money if they weren't getting something and looking for something in return. What they're looking for in return is huge corporate profits. This is what they intend to buy when they're buying these politicians and controlling the two political parties. And that's all that you can say is that they're buying their influence and they're going to shift things in the direction that will benefit them. And that means the only thing that they're ever concerned about, the only thing these Wall Street people are ever concerned about is profits. That's their bottom line. It's the one and only thing they care about, profits.
Well, the other thing what we see in regards to, we see that they're spending massive amounts, corporations and Wall Street, they're spending massive amounts of monies on campaigns, but in addition to that, they're spending, I believe the latest report is that they're spending close to $3 billion a year is to make certain that their special interests are represented there in Congress with all the lobbying and the lobbyists that they have. Is that correct?
Well, in my opinion, they're probably spending a lot more if you look at these reports. And now you've got these super funds, and we don't even know how much money they're spending. You see these ad after ad. You can turn on your television, listen to the radio, and it's nothing but ad after ad, attacking one party, attacking the other party. And even the attacks, though, they're very, insignificant attacks when both parties want the same thing. Both parties care only about Wall Street's interest. One party attacks the other party like they've attacked each other over Obamacare. You know, the Republicans really don't care about Obamacare. It's what they wanted in the first place because Obamacare is really Romney care. And, this is what the American people are getting from politics today. And The American people have no voice. I think if you ask most people, they will tell you they feel they have no voice. And it's not just that they feel they have no voice. They don't have any voice in the halls of Congress or even in the state legislatures. So, you know, Wall Street has thoroughly bought the whole political process. They control it. And it's up to the American people now to break free.
Now, let me ask you. I was saying within the last 25 years, has there been any type of connect, even from the time when you and I can remember back to the 60s and the 70s, was there a connect then with the leadership and also the people of this country back in the 60s and 70s? Because we could see many, we could see that there was a disconnect around the time of the Vietnam War. We could see during the Nixon administration, definitely there was a disconnect when Reagan was in. But do you see that the disconnect has actually gone further back, further than 25 years ago?
Well, it definitely goes further back. I mean, it goes back to the very founding of this country, where the people that are considered the, you know, the signers of the Declaration of Independence and created our Constitution and the Bill of Rights and everything, these people wanted complete control. I mean, these people wanted to enshrine slavery in the whole legal system of this country. And, you know, the whole process of this country has been one of struggling against you know, the capitalist oppressors and exploiters. And, you know, whether it's the Native American people trying to fight to retain ownership of their lands and resources, or working people trying to improve their standard of living in the mines and the mills and the factories of this country, they've always had to fight for their most basic human rights. And the government of this country has never just, you know, granted the American people, the American working people, anything of significance. Everything has been a battle and a fight and a struggle. And, you know, McCarthyism really did major damage to the whole political process and democracy in this country. And McCarthyism has never really ended, in my opinion. You know, we're still we're still working under the influence of the so-called Red Scare. And, you know, there's red baiting along with racism, the two biggest evils, in my opinion, in this, the political process in this country. And, you know, this has held us back in a major way. It's prevented the American people from fighting against imperialism. I just was reading Chalmers Johnson, a book that he wrote. He's quite well known for his, you know, pro-peace stands and everything. It's called Dismantling the Empire. But even he makes it appear that the American people are the ones that are supporting imperialism. And this isn't the case at all. The American people have no say. You know, we don't know for sure, you know, what the American people want, because the American people haven't been in a position of making policy in this country, neither domestic nor foreign. They've been completely isolated from any real decision-making in this country. So it's unfair to say that the American people as a whole support imperialism and empire. This just, in my opinion, isn't true at all. If we look at the polls, if polls are any indication, and I think they're a good indication because they pretty much reflect what I hear out on the street and talking to people, the majority of the people, American people, want peace, not war. They want our the wealth of this country, the resources, and our tax money used for things that people really need, whether it's health care, housing, education, to take care of the infrastructure. You know, if people ruled, if there was really majority rule in this country and real democracy, you know, we would have a totally different type of government, and we would have a government doing totally different kinds of things. You know, when it comes to issues of war and peace, or even the minimum wage, you know, the minimum wage, in my opinion, this whole discussion is a perfect example of how Wall Street controls this country, every facet. I mean, not only the government,
right,
but the news media and everything else. And then you have, you know, millions of workers, the majority of the working people in this country work under this these laws of at-will employment, which means employers, you know, if a worker starts to speak out even in their community and the employer gets a whiff of what's going on, like an employee talking about the minimum wage should be raised, an employer can fire that person for no reason
right.
at all under at-will employment. And this is, you know, how can we say we have a democracy when working people try to participate in the very basic decisions that affect their lives in the most personal ways and their standard of living? They don't have a say. You know, this isn't democracy. And
Alan, I would have to say when you look at a democracy, for the most part, it really starts right in your neighborhood and it starts right in the workplace. If as a nation we do not allow people to have a say-so in their communities or in the places where they work every day, you really don't have a democracy.
No, you don't. And that's the discussion that's got to take place. We have a lot of people talking about democracy in a very abstract way, and that's because I think we have these professors and these what I call muddle-headed middle-class intellectuals that are very well-heeled. You know, they define what democracy is, and they have no concept of what it means for, say, a person that's working in one of these casinos where workers have no rights, or working at Walmart or Target or Burger King or McDonald's. They have no concept that these workers, they don't even dare put their names on a petition a lot of the times, you know, advocating for a higher minimum wage or for peace instead of war, because they're afraid of being fired. You know, when we think about it, there's nothing, there's no more threat that a working person can experience than the threat of losing their job. And when
right.
you have to be threatened with losing your job because of what you say and what you do politically, I mean, this makes a mockery out of democracy. It's like, you know, you had Nat Turner and the slave rebellions. You know, they literally, here was a guy speaking out against the worst kind of oppression of all, slavery, and what did they do to him? They chopped off his head, you know?
Right.
And they've continued this repression, you know, since the days of slavery towards working people. And there has never been a day in this country when working people could have a say in their government.
Exactly.
This is a fact. I don't think there's anybody that dares to dispute that. We saw Eugene Debs thrown into prison. You know, he was running for president on the Socialist Party ticket, and he was thrown into prison for speaking out against an imperialist war, World War One. You know, where was there any freedom for Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party and working people that supported him? He got 1 million votes while sitting in prison for speaking out against the war.
Just because he was speaking out. He was speaking out against a war.
Exactly.
They threw him in prison for that.
Yep.
Alan, I look at some of the things that you know, I read your blogs from time to time, very frequently. I say the Democrats have become very adept to perverting the meaning of very basic words in the English language, like progressive and even
right.
peace. Give these people a dictionary, not your votes.
Yeah, well, that's the
what
way
were you saying when you said that?
What?
No, I like that.
Yeah, and I think the same thing, you know, I also point out the same thing, that there's this perversion of the word democracy. All these politicians talk about democracy as if it's something we really have and that people can really use to change their conditions and to participate in the political process, when everybody knows that that's not true. You know, if you were to ask somebody, do you feel like you have a say in your government? Do you feel your voice counts for anything? You know, what will most people say if you walk up to them and ask them that on the street? They'll look at you sort of strange to start with, and as if, you know, why would anybody ask me a stupid question like this when we all know that money dominates politics in this country?
Right, it does.
And these politicians, they'll look right at you, and they'll tell you, oh, we have a democracy. You know, I go and sit down with politicians in their offices all the time, and they'll look right at me and say, oh, it's great that you're participating in the political process. And I say, well, since you think it's great, how come, you know, I've been fired from jobs for speaking my mind about working conditions? You know, where is the democracy in that? Where is the democracy in you politicians not standing up for the rights of working people to even speak out? Not that we expect you to support our points of view, but where are you when it comes time to speak up and speak out, defending our rights to even talk about what's on our minds? You know, I know hundreds of workers personally that have been fired from their jobs for talking about working conditions, for talking about even potholes in the streets. I was just talking to a guy here in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There was a huge hole right on the corner that everybody was driving through, and he put up a big 55-gallon barrel in the hole so nobody would hit the hole. And the police came and threatened to arrest him for putting the barrel in the hole. And the hole had been there for over 3 weeks and had been trying to get the city to do something about it. The city wouldn't even mark off the hole. It was a hole, I have a picture of it, about 4 feet in diameter and about 2 feet deep. And they threatened him because he put the barrel in the hole so that people wouldn't drive through this huge pothole. You know, so this is a guy, just a working guy that didn't want people ruining their cars. And this is the way people are treated, threatened with arrest for doing something like that. Where's the criminality of this guy trying to prevent people from ruining their cars by putting a barrel in a pothole? You know, something so simple, it's hard to even conceive that a cop would threaten to arrest a guy for doing this.
Right.
And the city didn't even mark around it for 3 weeks after that.
Right. And I've seen that here in California. Ellen, last week we were talking about bait and switch, and you say these same individuals perverting and distorting the meaning of words fit in fits very well into their bait and switch scam. And Ellen, we see this, you know, the way these people that's supposed to be representing us in Congress, and we realize, as we were discussing a few minutes ago, they're representing a different interest. You said they say that they are for single universal health care. Now, we saw during Obamacare that many of them, they kept throwing that out initially, single-payer health care. And this was at the forefront of that discussion before Obamacare came out. And then they were talking about, having representation where people would be able to opt out. In other words, where they would not have to necessarily sign up for Obamacare. And then we could see that the pharmaceutical industry, they came in and they just had a very watered-down version because they came in with their big money, powerful interests, and now the politicians, they had a choice. They had to respond to the people that they were getting paid for, that bought their office, or these same representatives, they had the threat over their head that they would no longer be in Congress. But, Alan, this was another thing, bait and switch that they use, like I said, we were talking about last week, where, again, it shows that they're not representing the interests of the people that vote them into office. There's a certain disconnect there.
Right. The health care issue is a perfect example that the people of this country have no right to participate in the activities of their own government. You know, if this was an honest democratic government, we would have a full and open discussion about health care, and all the various ways to provide health care would be placed before the American people for their consideration and discussion, including a national public health care system, which is socialized health care. You know,
right.
They wouldn't even allow single-payer to be discussed. They destroyed the single-payer movement and told us all that they were providing us with something that was better and that would lead to single-payer. You know, that's obviously not true. These people just looked at us and they lied to us. Obama ran on a platform when he was campaigning for the nomination. He ran on a platform that included single-payer universal health care. And once he got that nomination, he started talking about and working in towards Obamacare. You know, the American people don't want Obamacare. And then the Democrats, they try to make it look like we should be defending Obamacare because the Republicans are attacking it. But this is the most ludicrous kind of thinking imaginable. You know, why? Because the Republicans attack something doesn't mean that the American people shouldn't also be in opposition to what's going on in this country. The Democrats have done this with everything. They say, oh, the Republicans oppose us, so we must be right. No, the Democrats and Republicans, they arrive at the same position, supporting the same objectives and goals, which is big profits. You know, and that's what the Obamacare is about, big profits. And it's the same thing with the minimum wage. You know, we look at like a state like Minnesota with a Democratic governor who claims to be a big-time liberal, Mark Dayton.
Uh-huh.
This is a billionaire governor. His wealth is derived directly from poverty-paid workers. His family owned the Dayton Hudson Company, which became the Target company. And, you know, this guy benefits, you know, beyond anybody's wildest dreams from paying workers poverty wages. And he promised living wages when he was running for office. He said if he was elected, he would make the minimum wage a real living wage. Once elected, he started talking about raising the minimum wage. Well, of course, everybody appreciates a raise, whether it's a quarter or $2 or $5. But that doesn't mean that what he's brought forward is a living wage. And it doesn't mean that the Democrats here in Minnesota have enacted a real living minimum wage. Quite to the contrary. They've enacted one more poverty wage. It's not going to even the wage increase that they legislated won't take place for 2 or 3 years. So, you know, where will that wage be by the time people start to have to spend that money to meet their basic needs and necessities of life? They'll be right back at $7.25 where the minimum wage is now in terms of buying power. You know, so they don't allow us, they don't allow any discussion of this in the public square. You know, they'll allow a letter to the editor here and a letter to the editor there. But when it comes to the major discussion that takes place, the news media will not allow, you know, any questioning of any of this, whether it's war and peace or the minimum wage or Obamacare and health care. You know, there's been no real discussion of any of these issues in the public square. And that's what a democracy is all about, where people can talk about these issues very freely without being intimidated and harassed and threatened. And from there, making a decision on what they want from their country and what kind of country they want. You know, that's what politics and democracy should be all about, what the majority of the people expect and want from their government. You know, we don't have anything like that in this country. The total farce is when you talk about democracy.
Well, Alan, I just want to mention once again, we appreciate you joining the program, The Socialist Insight. Today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program. He's a political analyst and social activist. And today we're discussing the growing gap between the two corporate parties and working people. And Alan, thanks again for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart.
Alan, you know, and what we're going to do is we're going to get a little bit more in the disconnect. Where I can see it, where it's coming from, is they make promises, even promises of democracy, which is, all of it's a lie, but they only deliver to Main Street. They deliver to Wall Street, but the promises always go to Main Street. But we really don't have a true democracy. Even our voting, the voting that's done in this country, even that electoral process is just a big scam. People go and think that they're voting for this politician or that one, and that they're putting candidates into office on the state and federal level. But even that whole process has become corrupt. The other thing is there's big money in politics now. The big corporations have paid legislators to put certain laws into position that give them the power over the whole political process, where they can vote their candidates in and get the type of government that they want, and the government doesn't work for the people. Now, you had mentioned in one of your this was on your site also, Obama and the Democrats promised to help Main Street. They bailed out Wall Street as homes foreclosures continued to soar. And what we could see, Alan, is that Obama, they said that they were going to create jobs. This Congress, Democrats and Republicans, were going to put legislation in place that they were going to end foreclosures. They were going to make home ownership more affordable. Alan, we have seen over the last few years where this government was pumping $85 billion a month into this government. They have just recently reduced it down to $65 billion. And even the things I see Janet Yellen, the Federal Reserve Chairman, talking about what she's going to do for Main Street. Alan, all of this stuff is still geared toward what they're doing for Wall Street. Because even that $65 billion a month that is currently going into this economy, it is only benefiting big corporations. It's not doing anything to help people that we see every day, the working people of this country. What do you think when you see about these promises that they made over the last two terms of this president and also of this Congress, that they haven't delivered on any of the promises, but they have fulfilled every promise that they have made to Wall Street?
Well, that shows the duplicity and hypocrisy in what is referred to as democracy in this country. The majority of the people were totally fed up with Republicans and Bush, and they elected Obama thinking and believing that Obama was going to turn this country around. And, you know, it's really sickening because the people expected so much, and Obama just lied, you know, like I said, right to a person's, to people's faces. He lied. It's no accident that Obama talked about solving the problems of the people on Main Street while he knew he was going to really further enrich the Wall Street investor crowd. You know, this was no accident. He used the American people. He took advantage of what the American people wanted. He knew what the American people wanted. All the politicians know what the American people want. All the American people want is a decent living and decent livelihood, a decent place to live, good education, jobs. You know, I just heard a Republican being interviewed on TV yesterday, and the reporter asked her, you know, what's the main plank in your platform? And she said, jobs, jobs, jobs. Well,
right.
What kind of jobs do these Republicans want? They want poverty wage jobs where, you know, these the Wall Street business crowd can continue to exploit workers and by paying them poverty wages while they enrich themselves. I mean, the profits in this country are so enormous. The whole Wall Street crowd, you look at the record profits, and a working person can't even really imagine what these profits amount to. There's such an enormous amount of wealth that we're talking about. And yet these people don't want to give a penny towards providing for the public welfare and the public good. This is the real hypocrisy in our system, in my opinion, the capitalist system and this capitalist democracy. You know, we should start referring to this as the capitalist democracy, and what we need is a socialist democracy. And working people used to talk in these terms in the 1930s and 1940s. They used to make this distinction. And it was, you know, beginning in 1946, 1947, when these vicious right-wing Wall Streeters came to power, and they had this massive anti-communist crusade that silenced the voices of socialists and communists and the left wing and the trade union movement and the people's movements for peace and social justice. And then they took this heavy hand and they smothered any kind of real progressive thinking in this country. And then they continued to call this democracy when, you know, liberals and progressives and leftists have no voice at all. Their voices would be completely opposite of what Wall Street wants. And, you know, this is the voice of the American people, the majority of the American people that has been silenced and is still not being heard, you know, even after, you know, over 50 years after McCarthyism is supposedly dead. This is how this kind of political repression, governmental political repression, carries forward and carries on. And we see it all the time. We see it in the Democratic Party, the red baiting. You know, you start talking about the Israeli killing machine and the rights of the Palestinian people, and I can guarantee you what you're going to be labeled, you're going to be labeled a communist, whether you are or not. I happen to be one. So the label, you know, is appropriate. But
they may even label you a terrorist.
Yeah, well, they do. The in the files that the FBI maintains, they, you know, for myself and literally millions of people in this country, we're called subversives. And, you know, what does that word mean? The word itself means that, you know, this is somebody that's going to use some kind of devious methods and violent methods to, you know, overthrow the government or get what they want from the government. When this, all we want as socialists and communists is for the majority to rule, you know, for the majority of the people to have the right to make decisions in this country and to participate in the decision-making process. It's one thing to say, okay, let the Wall Street crowd have their say. I have no problem with that. Let them have their say. But what about the rights of working people to have their say in opposition to what Wall Street wants? You know, where is there any force in this country defending the rights of the working people to have their say? It simply doesn't exist. Once people try to exercise those rights in one way or another, whether it's buying people off or firing them from their jobs, you know, the corporate crowd uses these devious methods to destroy any kind of democracy that begins to develop. And this is what we're experiencing, and this is what the American people are going to have to overcome. We're going to have to develop some kind of organizations that can, you know, challenge Wall Street for political and economic power. We want real democracy. After all, isn't that what democracy is about? If the majority of people don't like the way Wall Street is running the country, we should have a say, and we should assert our rights and take the initiative to challenge Wall Street for political and economic power.
Alan, I'm looking at this thing, and indeed, I'm still talking about Obama and the politics that we see in this country, and you know, we realize that the people that are representing, supposedly representing us in Congress, they're representing certain interests that they have and their interests that they represent. You say we were promised by Obama, and when I see Obama, you know, Obama makes a promise, but the Congress, they do the delivering. Unfortunately, they don't deliver to Main Street. We were promised by Obama an open and transparent government. What we got was the government cloaking its undemocratic and murderous schemes in secrecy, combined with the most outrageous litany of never-ending lies, deceit, cover-up, and political repression. Alan, I mean, if there's, you know, how are you going to trust people like that? They're supposed to be the leaders and the people that are supposed to be representing you in your towns and counties and throughout the country. Because it's not only Obama that we're talking about, but we're talking about the people that are there in Congress. That's what they, we don't have a transparent government. Everything is done in secrecy, and you hit it around the head in your statement there.
Yeah, and it's going to continue to get worse. What we need to develop is some kind of mass organization, you know, maybe call it some kind of new broom coalition to sweep the government clean or something. I don't know. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't see one single member of Congress, either the in the House or the Senate, that can be relied upon to consistently, you know, support what working people in this country need. There's some people that will make some noises as if they're supporting the needs of working people and the concerns of working people and voicing those concerns, but they're never consistent, and they seem to only voice those concerns when they know that the majority will not support them, so they take these positions to try and make themselves look good. Keith Ellison here in Minnesota is a perfect example of that. And, you know, you have members of Congress across the country that do the same thing. If they know the majority of the Democrats are going to be voting one way that's in opposition to what the American people really want and what working people need, they'll venture the you know, speaking out and say, we oppose this, and they'll vote against that once in a while, but not very often. We see these Democrats and Republicans voting together. And, you know, the call is for bipartisan unity. Here, I'm traveling around Michigan right now, and what I hear is that, you know, the Republicans have this stranglehold on government, and these union leaders begging, and that's what they're doing. They're just begging. They're saying, give us a chance to at least have a say in our government and for, you know, the Democrats and Republicans to work together the way it used to be. And this is, you know, they're not talking about challenging the Democrats and the Republicans because both work against working people. They're basically begging and saying, come on, you Republicans, let us have a say in here. Let the Democrats have a say. And, you know, but what do we get from these Democrats when they do have a supermajority? We get nothing from them. Minnesota is a perfect example. There are 13 states in this country with Democratic supermajorities. Have any of these states with Democratic supermajorities passed a real living minimum wage? No, none of them. You know, and we can't count on the Democrats for anything. And this is why people like Eugene Debs began to run on the Socialist Party ticket for political office. And, you know, people will say, well, Debs never made any real inroads, and the Socialist Party never made any real inroads in the political process in this country. But that's just not true. We had entire city councils in some of the smallest communities and largest cities that were dominated by socialists at the time that Eugene Debs was running for president. And,
right.
You know, we had socialists and communists dominating all kinds of city councils and county commissions and even state governments, like in Minnesota during the 1930s. And, you know, when people got together and were determined to have a say and a voice in government, they won that. They won that say, and they won that right to have a say in government. But we, at this point, working people are under the thumbs, you might say, of these millionaire labor leaders who really don't care about breaking free from this two-party trap that we're in. You know, Richard Trumka will once in a while make some sounds and utterances against, you know, we don't like what the Democrats have done. But when it comes election day, he's right there supporting these same Democrats that he said he didn't like what they were doing. You know,
he's almost standing right behind the podium.
Yeah.
He's almost standing right behind the podium.
Exactly.
Alan, I just want to, I'm going to read this little statement, and I just want to get your opinion on it. According to an article by Michael Snyder, today there are 250 members of Congress that are millionaires. According to the Wall Street Journal, the median net worth of members of Congress is now $913,000. The collective net worth of all the members of Congress increased by 25% between 2008 and 2010. Meanwhile, the standard of living in the United States has fallen lower over the past 3 years than at any other time that has ever been recorded in the U.S. history. The net worth of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi increased by 62% from 2009 to 2010. In 2009, it was reported that she had a net worth of $21.7 million, and in 2010, it was reported that she had a net worth of $35.2 million. Alan, we just have the rich representing the super rich.
Exactly.
What is your opinion on that statement?
Well, you know, my personal opinion is how can we expect people with that kind of wealth to even understand the plight of working people in this country today who are facing this cost of living crisis? Every single working class family in this country is facing this cost of living crisis. They can't afford the basic necessities of life. They can, if they have two or three or four credit cards, they can purchase, you know, much of what they need, but they are in debt for the rest of their lives. And, you know, these people in Congress, in the House and the Senate, they have no concept whatsoever what a working person has to go through to try to survive in this day and age with the tremendous problems that they're having. You know, they can go to the supermarket, and they don't think of the prices of anything. They can buy whatever they want. They don't think about the cost of buying a home or paying for auto or car insurance and health care insurance, because they can afford all of this. It means nothing to them. They don't think of the cost of a higher education, sending their kids to college and university, because they can afford it all. You know, they might whine a little bit and pretend that they're perturbed by the higher prices, but the higher prices mean nothing to them. You know, they go and fill up their cars. They don't think about the price of gas. They couldn't care less. You know, they don't care what it costs to get to their next campaign meeting. We have a congressman, my own congressman, here in Minnesota, Congressman Colin Peterson. He flies to every campaign meeting. You know, he has a personal airplane that he flies from airport to airport in the congressional district. He brags about it. He doesn't even drive. He flies. And, you know, this is something that it's hard for a working person to even conceive, that people are living like these parasites do that are in Congress, you know. And the same way that the people in Congress have no idea what it means to have to try and survive as working people do from day to day and from paycheck to paycheck when they're lucky enough to have a paycheck. You know, there's millions of people in this country that remain unemployed. Well, almost every single politician will tell you that the main plank in their platform and programs are jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, if we had the jobs that these politicians talk about, we would have no unemployment in this country. But the irony is that these politicians who talk jobs, 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 they won't even make themselves responsible for attaining and maintaining full employment by passing legislation that would make that their job responsibility. So, you know, this is more of the
that would hurt their bottom line.
Yeah. And, you know, working people are in just a terrible situation in this country today. And it's only they're only going to continue, their livelihoods and their standard of living is going to continue to go down, down, and down as the profits soar. That's why profits are soaring. The Wall Street crowd, they make greater profits off the poverty of the working people by pushing them into poverty. When they decrease wages, their profits go up. So, you know, Nancy Pelosi, you know, her husband owns big businesses. You know, his profits go up, just like Governor Mark Dayton's standard of living goes up as the standard of living of working people is being pushed down. You know, this is the source of their profits, the poverty of the people.
Alan, we're still, you know, this is a very interesting topic today, the growing gap between the two corporate parties and working people. And people have to understand is you're electing these people to go into public office on the state, even in your own communities at a national level. And these politicians, they give you 0% representation. They only pay their way, not vote their way into office. Alan, another statement out of the same article, only the wealthy have the money to turn Congress members' heads in the direction the wealthy want them to go. It has even been said many times that members of Congress are so controlled by the lobbyists that sometimes the lobbyists actually control the writing of many of the bills. According to On the Issues, Jeb Bush on gun control, in 2005, the governor signed into law another piece of NRA legislation on the topic of gun control. The bill was written by the NRA and expanded the rights of Floridians to use deadly force when threatened in public places. This proposal, known as the Stand Your Ground Bill, expanded the rights of people to use guns. But here are lobbyists going in representing a private interest, and this has not worked to the benefits of the people of the communities. People had no say-so. They had no say-so in how this legislation would be delivered to them. All of a sudden, they just realized that, you know, they were, you know, potential victims in their communities. Legislation that even now that the state still refused to repeal. What is your comments in regards to that statement, Alan?
Well, when it comes to the National Rifle Association writing legislation, we might as well have the Ku Klux Klan writing the legislation. And, I mean, that's what this organization is. And it's these lobbyists and their organizations that you know, are putting up the money. They're, when they write this legislation, you know, what can we expect? Can we expect anything of any kind of, to improve the quality of life of working people? Or to, you know, when the NRA writes legislation, what are they really writing legislation for? To repress people of color is what it's all about. It's racist legislation, you know, and they disguise it in many other ways. But, you know, it's really sickening when I see Democrats and Republicans just cower before the National Rifle Association. You know, there's not an organization in this country that you can find that's much more racist than the National Rifle Association. In fact, it includes members of the KKK and all these right-wing outfits. So, you know, this is something that's very dangerous when an organization like this is writing legislation. But the lobbyists don't stop there. The lobbyists have written partnership, this huge trade deal. You know, the American people haven't even been allowed to see what's in this Trans-Pacific Partnership, and yet some 600 corporate lobbyists have all contributed to writing this legislation, and they're going to push it through, and they are pushing it through, and they're bribing the members of Congress left and right to vote for this. You know, some of them may say, oh, we're opposed to it. We want an open and transparent process to be had with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But in the end, it's just like with NAFTA, they're going to end up voting for it. You know, we had the same kind of crap during the Clinton administration with all this so-called reform of Wall Street. Oh, it was going to you know, we don't have to worry about these corporations doing these dirty and wrong things, so we can just get rid of any kind of regulations and legislation that controls what Wall Street is doing. And, you know, we see what's happened today. You know, it's impossible to control these corporations when they have so much money. When I hear people talking about Citizens United, and they say the first thing we got to do before we do anything in this country is reverse the Supreme Court decision, and then we'll be able to get some reforms in this country. Well, you know, that's just not true. Money is always going to find a way to have influence, and the only thing that can combat that is massive organizations of the people that understand what's really taking place in this country, that understand how Wall Street operates and how the capitalist system and imperialism operate. You know, otherwise, if we don't understand that, we're going to continue to be the victims of the very system that exploits and represses and oppresses the working people and anything that stands in the way of what Wall Street wants.
Alan, this is the last statement, and we're going to conclude this because you say very frequently that we need to form some type of political structure where we can have representation on a grassroots level rather than there from the oligarchs. But, Alan, this is the definition of an oligarchy, according to Concise Encyclopedia, is rule by the few, often seen as having self-serving ends. Most oligarchies have resulted when governing elites were recruited exclusively from the ruling class, which tend to exercise power in its own interests. I just want you to, you know, and explain to our listeners, because some people I even find today, they don't understand when I say oligarchy, they don't understand what that term even means. But could you explain what that is and how they recruit, you know, people to serve their interests? And I might mention, we even see that in Europe today.
Well, for sure. We see it all over the world, you know, whether it's the United States, Europe, Africa, Asia, South America.
When we say an oligarchy, what are we referring to so people, our listeners, can understand what that is?
Well, put it very simply, it's when the wealthiest people control the political process for their own ends. And that's what we have in this country today. That's what capitalism leads to. And capitalism is in its highest stage of imperialism, where these the bankers and the big business interests, the Wall Street interests, have come together and have come to control society to for their own selfish ends. And, you know,
Alan, I just want to ask you, I want to ask you in your opinion, because what I see, what took place in Iraq years ago and how that was an allied government to the United States, and what happened to Saddam Hussein, and by no means do I, would I think that he was some type of a saint. I don't think he should have been murdered the way he was. But when I look at countries like that, the United States poured billions of dollars into their defense spending. They spent billions of dollars into that economy, and actually he was a man who went from rags to riches. He was one of the richest persons there in the Middle East. But, Alan, we see this happening in Europe. We have seen it happening in the Middle East. But we see that these wealthy people are actually installed, and they're put in those positions, and much of that is done with the backing and support of this country. I mean, right now we see it, what's happening in Ukraine and what happened there in Kiev. That is a good example of what is taking place when we talk about oligarchies.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it in my mind that Wall Street is top dog in the world, and anything that goes on in the world, Wall Street has its fingers in it. And, the world's going to continue to be a mess. Our country's going to continue to be a mess as long as Wall Street's fingers are in every single aspect of our lives and controlling society. And, you know, people aren't looking deeply enough at the connections. You know, you have to look at the industries, all these corporations and where they are and what they're doing and what they're getting out of different countries, the resources, the cheap labor that they're getting. And when you begin to look at these things, then you begin to understand why, the U.S. Marines go here and the Navy SEALs go there. And, this
they're protecting
whole thing
Wall Street's interests. They're protecting
exactly Wall
Street's interests.
That's exactly what they're doing.
It's not about protecting freedom and democracy and installing democracy. It's about Wall Street. Alan, I have less than 2 minutes. You said our only hope is to break free from the two-party trap by challenging Wall Street for political and economic power. That was your statement. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that Wall Street controls both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and Wall Street has set a trap for us. What they do is they push all these reactionary agenda of war and attacking the needs of the people, and they'll make the Democrats say nice things in order to get elected after the Republicans have been totally discredited and have done so much damage to society. We saw that with George Bush. The Republican Party should be dead by now, but Obama helped to revive the Republican Party because Wall Street needs both the Democrats and the Republicans in order to control us. Once
Obama was the best thing to happen for the Republican Party.
He sure was, and the only thing that only way that's going to change is when the American people start to look for an alternative political party that really represents what people need.
I have 30 seconds. How can our listeners reach you?
Well, they can call me at 651-587-5541. That's my cell phone. I'm on the road now, so you can reach me at that number. Or you can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and you'll come across my blog with all my contact information.
And Alan, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining the Socialist Insight. I'd like to apologize for all the interruptions we had at the beginning. And we look forward to having you to join us once again next week. Thanks again, Alan. Thank you, Ruth Ann. Have a good night.
My pleasure. Well, good night, everybody.
Thank you.
You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Good evening, and welcome to The Dialogue. I'm Ruth Ann, and here's our facilitator, Ken Withrow.
Hello, how you doing?
Hello.
So, Who do we have so far? Is Karen on?
You and I and Karen. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Hey,
okay,
guys.
So we're kind of, I guess, working our way through moneyless societies. And when we ended last week, I know I probably conned a few of you to go look at Zardoz and watch that movie. But what was the – I do not remember the point to me even saying that. The snake eating its tail. So we were talking about, like, the inevitable demise of currency and that transition into it. And then we got into, like, the telltale signs. And at one point we got into Bitcoin and alternative currencies and whether they would work or not.
Well,
and I don't know if we got very far.
Well, I did want to mention, somebody asked me the difference between a cashless society and a moneyless. And I think that so many people, I know
wow.
When I think of a cashless society, I think of the whole thing with the charge cards and things like that. So still there's a monetary value put on everything, but we just don't pay in cash or something.
Wow, that's something I've never thought about. But isn't that, Karen, that's what Bitcoin's basically doing, like these all the digital currencies, the credit
yeah.
cards, right?
Yeah, the base concept is that they're creating a scarcity. And they're creating that scarcity by each Bitcoin being generated via a mining process. So there's only so many total Bitcoins, and there's also, a value assigned to each one. So I guess my baseline, if I were talking about moneyless or if I were talking about cashless, is I would say, is this based on a scarcity or an abundance? That would be the measuring point, because moneyless, in my sense, would be you would have an abundance built in rather than a scarcity. So you don't measure an abundance. There's just enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
You measure what there's not enough of. So let's just say, for instance, if we use the technology of free energy, as envisioned by Nikola Tesla before he was shut down in his efforts to bring free energy into human society, the main reason why he was shut down was because they couldn't meter it, they couldn't measure, they couldn't make it a scarcity and therefore charge for it. So that would have been a case where historically we could have put an abundance into the system of energy, right, smack in the middle of the industrial age, which would have been a heck of a deal for humanity, which
mm-hmm.
would not be measured. You wouldn't have to measure it. You wouldn't have to say, you use so many hours, therefore we're going to charge you so much money. So to me, cashless is just simply you're not carrying around, Federal Reserve notes and or coins and or gold coins and or silver coins, and you've got this little piece of plastic that goes to a computer that says you have X amount of units, whatever you measure that in, and that's what you trade for something that's worth so many measure of units. That's not really the same thing. It's still based on scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're measuring it still.
That's good.
I forgot about that. Scarcity was like the key thing we sort of all accepted as what you would call the root of the problem is creating scarcity versus abundance.
I would dare say that the number one thing that our economic system produces is scarcity, because when you monetize something, you need to make it worth something. And then since we measure everything in terms of debt, we make it a scarcity. So we're now making things scarce that normally hadn't historically been scarce. Like I said, I was talking about water. Water used to be something.
I was just thinking that.
Unless you lived in the desert, it's somewhat abundant. And now
mm-hmm.
because of our water policies that are scarcity-oriented, we're now creating a scarcity, and it's going to be worth more per barrel than oil eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Fine.
Yeah, after this...
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's one of the new, quote-unquote, wars over water in Africa, especially. That,
really?
That's one of the resources, yeah.
I didn't know that.
It goes back. I mean, we're trying to strip everything out of Africa. So
yeah, that's true.
One of the natural resources.
Well, so and one thing we never got to out of all this, then, is... If we know the dilemma, then what would be minus, once again, having, you know, an ultimately conscious society where, you know, you whatever you need is available, period, and we all work together. Until then, what would be, I guess, the stepping points other than, you know, changing people's attitudes, great, but the, you know, like to get to a point, how would we end up having a society that does not need a symbolic exchange and can just exchange goods and services for goods and services and have the availability of these things that make us have to work so hard? Like, for instance, we would need free energy. We would need basically all the your standard necessities have to be freely available and you don't have to pay for them, I would think, would be one of the key components to getting to a society not using money. Water cannot be bought. Energy cannot be bought. Food cannot be bought. You can go and, like, pay someone to cook you food, you know, go to a restaurant, but, like, we should always have food, like the basic necessities, the heat, cooling, roof over your head. I would think those components have to exist for people to not need a system of exchange and money, do you think, or does it...
Well, right, but it's going to... There's a transitional period, and that's where I think a basic guaranteed income, everyone comes in, because at that point, people will have enough to eat, to be clothed, to have a place to live. And, another thing that we can do, and we can do it right now, and this is stop giving in to all these companies that are making things that we don't need. Like, use common sense. You don't have to have the color for this month, okay? You know, that kind of thing. It's like, where the fuck do people get this idea that, you know, the more they buy, the better they are? So I think that's one major thing. Don't keep consuming things that we don't need. Don't keep buying this stuff. Another thing, I touched on this a couple weeks ago, was the time banks. And, you know, you were talking about that and saying that that would be better than barter. And the barter thing, I think there's more barter going on right now than there has been since I've been alive, probably since the 1800s when this country, at least in this country, the U.S., when it was settled, you know, quote-unquote settled, when the white people came and killed all the Indians, settled, there was a lot of bartering going on. I mean, people didn't really use that much money. I mean, maybe they would when they went into the store for flour, but they helped each other. You know, they put up the barns, they put up the houses, they took turns doing the field work, things like that. And so I think that's on the increase now. Just trading off, okay, I can do this, and for that, I mean, myself, I have created Reiki sessions that I would give and chakra cleansing and all this for help, since I'm not very good with computers, so for some technical help. I also did that for my tattoo. So there's people around who are very much into
I guess
trading.
That happens a lot. We've been doing that too. You know, there's a acupuncturist that lived with us for a while, and man, she would trade all day long. I trade all the time. You know, I'll help someone work on their house or whatever. You know, people trade on my farm constantly. They'll come out and give me a little bit of labor, and I'll turn around and help them design a better greenhouse or whatever they want, you know.
I think it's
happening.
It's picking up. I think it's picking up now.
I do too.
Do you too, Karen?
I don't look for it. That's so funny. I haven't noticed, but you know what? We all have experiences with it. So I didn't 10 years ago. So
exactly.
That's a great point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Briefly, when I needed office space a couple of years ago, when I had my computer business, I volunteered to be the receptionist for certain hours of the day, and that gave me access to office space and Wi-Fi and stuff away from home.
Wow.
So that was really valuable to me. And,
yeah,
I think people are doing more of that, doing a lot more of that. I think we should accept the fact that we won't be able to do everything, but we can do as much as we can. And Ruth Ann, I was really glad you brought up the color thing because Brett and I were talking about planned obsolescence, you know, and consumerism. And one of the things they do is they actually rotate all the popular colors through the color wheel every year.
Yeah.
So a
yeah.
committee sits down somewhere in Europe and decides what the color palette is going to be, you know, because you're like orange is the new red kind of stuff, right? But it'll be a really specific shade so that next year you can't wear that shade because it'll clash with all your other stuff. So you'll have
well,
to buy another.
Yeah,
so you can have purpose.
These people,
wow.
When they get together, you've got somebody from the car industry, I mean more than one,
yeah.
somebody from clothing, somebody mm-hmm. from draperies and towels. I mean all of this. And it's about 18 to 36 months ahead of the season.
Yeah.
So they know
yeah.
what they're going to push. But like you said, it's a very precise shade of green or something.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
yeah, isn't that disgusting? And everybody, not everybody, but so many people just fall for it. Well, you know, they've got something perfectly fine that they got 2 years ago, but, oh, my God. It's not the right color. I've got to dump it.
It doesn't match anything, you know, because everything's rotated through the color palette, you know. So
exactly.
now it's off.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
and,
it. You know, I don't think about that too much. I'm an absolute boring dresser, though. I am two pairs of jeans, a couple pairs of shorts, some hoodies that never match anything. And, you know, I have two pairs of shoes, flip-flops and boots. And the flip-flops are on from November, or from March till November, you know. And I grew up surfing, and I loved what I wore growing up. And so I've never changed. There's always a pair of shorts available in a store, and I don't care what they look like. Do they have more than four pockets? So I could put crap in them. That's it. Like, I love being a guy. I absolutely love it. Because I can get away with this, and they just thought us as some dumb guy, and I'm okay. I've
well,
never fallen
victim.
Everything goes
with jeans, right? Everything goes with jeans. So, hey.
Oh, yeah. jeans,
good to go.
That's designed obsolescence right there, man. The jean was designed, and that was it. You know, it really, they screwed themselves with that one because.
Well, they designed
I mean,
it. It was like workwear. It was designed back. They were dungarees, and they were designed in like the 1850s.
Yeah.
For working, and they were.
You know
so
what?
Funny.
But now there's certain times, and women. I mean, jeans. Yes, you need jeans, but every year there's a little tiny bit of a difference. Some brand name comes
mm-hmm.
out, something, and. And it's the same, Karen will tell you, with every kind of makeup, from eyeshadow to fingernail polish to lipstick. You know, it's not what looks best on you, it's what is in. Let me give you an example.
Yeah, what you're told to do.
Let me give you an example, because this just, I was screaming on the phone, okay? A few years ago, I used to watch, what's that, Dancing with the Stars also, because I like to watch dancing, but... So, you know, it was a few years ago because I haven't had a TV for quite a while. Anyway, it was when this might have been after I was not watching it, but a friend of mine was talking about heels, you know, being like flesh, we're white, and like flesh-colored heels, like the dancers
mm-hmm.
on there wore because it makes their legs look longer, right? If you don't have, you know, like your foot is a completely different color from your leg, that shortens the way it looks. Okay, so... And she was just determined she was going to get some. Well, here's the thing. The woman doesn't ever go anywhere to dance. She goes once in a blue moon someplace where she actually wears heels. But she was determined to get a pair of those. And I don't know if she ever did. If she did, she never told me because I'm such a noise about it. It's like, what are you thinking? Why? Well, because it'll make my legs feel slimmer. Well, the woman wears black pants all the time. So, you know, it's I just couldn't get, but because it was really the thing then, and so then I did, I saw in some magazine or online or something, there were several of these, like, skin-colored, flesh-colored, you know, it's like considered bone, like a real light tan, whatever. But I don't know if she ever got any. But that was just, that was the, what do you call it, like the mask, whatever. It was something she would never wear, did not need, but yet, it was the thing. She wanted to be up on whatever. So,
well, God, they do that with cars. When you brought up cars earlier, and I was thinking about this, you, right now, there's always a new car being sold on every lot through every town. And yet, cars last maybe 200,000 miles. And yeah, they get a little beat up, but like people feel that they're doing okay if they have a nice car. And
right.
People feel they're doing okay if they got these new things, you know?
Yeah.
A McMansion. But like Mother's Day, we went to the Lake Michigan and hung out at the beach. And we're watching this boat go by. And now it's crossing the entire horizon in front of us from basically Michigan to Chicago, and then it went back. We were there for hours, and I just watched this thing going back and forth with everybody sitting on it. And I'm thinking, what are you doing right now? What are you doing? You know, like you're burning gas out on the water going back and forth, and basically lying to yourself that you're living a good life because you have a boat and you're going back and forth. It's a pain in the ass to get in the water. I'm not saying boats aren't fun. I'm saying, like, we lost our need for utilitarian and we just consume, you know? Like, I was complaining to Gabe today about the green lawns and the neighbors behind us and how Julie's uncle cut down all the trees in his yard. He had, like, black walnuts and stuff. He's like, I'm tired of picking the stuff up off the grass. I'm like, dude, I have 37 black walnuts on my property, and I want more. I'm like, that is incredible.
Hey, we're planting pecans, man. We're over here trying to plant some pecan trees. So.
Oh, God, I would love to have some. It blows me away. Like, you think, like, you look at the footprint of a tree, and then you look at its actual square footage of chlorophenated coverage, where it can actually make oxygen compared to that same footprint of grass.
Right.
And it drives me nuts. I'm like, what are you doing? You know, they think the green pristine look, you know, it's because you're told that's what it is. I'm mowing down their dandelions. It's the crazy things. I mean, we're taught this. We, in every aspect, that's fashion industry, in every aspect, it's everywhere. You are told to consume. And if we stop consuming, what happens? Then you don't need money. Because everything is consummation, every single aspect of it. You spend to consume. If all your basic life necessities were free, you would not need money. You would barter, hey, I like that. I'll give you this for that. The way Native Americans did with trading.
Okay.
We would go right back to that. Even with technology.
Well, it'd be great, though, with technology. I mean, because all of the things that you learn and experiment with and spend time with friends working on and just kicking back, you know,
mm-hmm.
And instead of worrying about these jobs that more people than not actually hate, if they don't hate the work they do, they hate the situation they're in.
Yeah. They're trapped.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Because of that boat you're talking about, I mean, that couple has to, you know, they're doing three jobs a week instead of two because they've got to support the boat. And
pay the dock fees, whatever.
Yeah, and all of that is one of those things where we don't, like, every block in every town could have, the people in it could go in together, buy a lawnmower and take turns. You know, that kind of thing. We don't have to have the damn thing. Everybody doesn't have to have it.
I agree.
If they have to use a weed whacker, or some of these people, I just don't get it, but anyway, snow blowers and leaf blowers and all that crap. one for the neighborhood, you know, I mean, and it doesn't have to be the whole block, but I mean, five or six people right there together, surely you can figure out a schedule, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And that
oh,
kind
yeah.
of thing. So, but no, everybody is so, oh, but we've got to have this, and so we have to get a storage shed and put out back and take up half our yard space because we've got
mm-hmm.
to have a place to put these things. So, it's just, there's so many things that we can do, but we don't even think about it because of the way we've been indoctrinated.
Yeah,
exactly.
So that's right.
Hi, guys. This is Brett.
Hey, Brett.
Hi. I was talking to Karen this morning. She wanted me to mention what you know about what you guys were talking about and the no spare parts syndrome. You know, like everything that they make is like made to break and all that stuff. And I don't know if you talked
oh, yeah.
about that already, but yeah, it's all made to break. And really, all we need is one good one to last a lifetime or whatever. But you know,
right? Planned obsolescence.
Planned obsolescence,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah,
yeah the one thing with, for instance, like you're a car. Cars
yeah.
don't need to be, they don't need to break down, you know? Like a good, well-built
yeah.
car will last well into 400,000 or 500,000 miles. Basic maintenance. You get, like, think of the lawnmower and get a car for the neighborhood. Now, say if you're insanely busy. Well, if we changed our lifestyles, you wouldn't be insanely busy. And
okay.
you could do more, like, you know, see kids stay in sports and, you know, things like that stick around. Okay, well, first off, you could have neighborhood carpools. You could, there's so many things people do share on one level and don't realize that they're only 2 inches from making that big change. And you just go, why doesn't each block have a series of vehicles? I mean, if you look in a commune, or if you go to really any designed community, they usually do have a situation like that where, you know, I mean, it's already established. It's a village in itself. You know, you can go to an Amish, you know, ones that aren't super into the doctrine and will keep a trucker van there. They can use them to go places, and they do, but in the end, everyone shares the machinery. You know, you can have a computer. You have a series of computers, like at the library, you know, instead of having to have one on you at all times with your, you know, iPhone. I mean, I don't know how I would give up doing it, but that would be one of those things.
Well, you don't have to. This is the thing. You don't have to. If you spend hours and hours and hours and hours a day online,
yeah.
Then, fine, you'll have a computer. But I like what you reminded me that some cities, Chicago being one of them, some companies are starting up where for X number of dollars a month, you have a share of a car from this company. They have a bunch of these little cars when you need it.
Oh,
you know,
the ride-sharing guys, yeah.
And just go and grab a car. You will buy the gas that you use. But insurance and everything's paid part of, you know, the fee that you pay. And so, you know, there you go. You can leave town if you need to or want to, and you've got a car. But in the meantime, you don't have to worry about housing it or upkeeping on it.
No.
So I think that's a great thing because, you know, people in cities a lot don't have cars because they don't need them. If you're in a big city that has good transport like Chicago, you don't need a car. And in fact...
Well, you know, now, there's a really good point because you kind of hit something that was... I'm looking at, all right, what are the dilemmas? What are the attachments we have to let go of? I live in a rural area. I mean, the town's tight-knit. It's a college town, but I'm 10 minutes away from it, and everyone lives on... We're on a major highway, you know? Like, my driveway pulls out onto Route 2, State Road 2 in Indiana. And I to get anywhere, there's not even bike trails back where I'm at, you have to have a vehicle. Now, I have a lot of people that come around, but let's say, like, a small family lives out on my – there's neighbors like that. And to get around, they don't have a car or can't just go to one very easily. So do those people in that predicament, you know, like – to get a car in hand versus, say, public transport, which one thing, the solution to it all is that there is public transport, that hits every neck of the woods. Well, let's assume transition point. What do we do? Well, if everybody had a vehicle that lasted forever, every family or whatever, and it was fuel efficient, you know, electric cars, whatever. And kind of like a Minority Report, you know, the cars were just attached to the grid and something, you know. Let's say we decide to go that route. And you could either do it that way, or you would have to then separate it out. Like if you were to live in a city, you have different obligations. But let's say you lived in a rural area. Your expenditures would be higher. Your necessities would be different. And that's like that all over the world, you know. So then in that choice, going into that choice to acquire the things you need, are they just given? Now, mind you, when we get to a point where that's all just available, it doesn't matter. But, it, you know, this transition area, you know, that how do these people do this? This is are the tricks that people make excuses.
Some people who have a sense of balance actually are doing a lot more bicycles now than before.
Yeah.
And for different reasons. I mean, some for their health. But some just because they don't want to be part of the pollution problem. So they aren't buying huge purchases if they're trying to carry a bike. I mean, but they could, you know, borrow a car if they need. But they're doing a lot more biking. Also, in these small towns, golf carts are very big.
Golf carts. I just had the biggest brain fart. Probably the solution right there is you go back to the time bank. You know, if we're trying to cut that automobile down and there is a ride share available and we're trying to go moneyless, then you invest your time. You know, if like you use that car a lot to do a lot of things, like say for instance, back in February, you know, it was negative 14 out here and we needed groceries. So what do? Well, in a moneyless society, probably not going to work. You know, so we would probably gauge it, figure that out. But we got to go get basic amenities. Let's say we're growing all our food now indoors around there, and I don't got to worry about that. But there's things I need to get, you know, whatever, you name it. And I got to get a ride because I can't ride my bike because it would take me 3 hours in unplowed snow to get there. So I would have to then get a ride, but I don't have money because we have just gotten rid of money. How would I fund that ride? Is this a community resource? And is this community resource built to that level?
Well, you may be the person who is the mechanic for that ride. You know, there's so many different ways to do that. Also, I think at that point we're going to probably be a little more prepared, like if you know that you're probably not going to, back to the pioneers in the 1800s, okay, they would go into town every month during the good weather. But when it was bad weather, they might not go in for 3 or 4 months. But yet they had those basics because they stockpiled ahead. So I think
that's a good point, too. We're creatures of a habit.
You know, and we don't need to go... I love the whole European thing in the nice, well, it's that way in the Caribbean, too. You can just run down and get fresh vegetables and fruit every day. Where I live, it doesn't matter because they're not going to be any fresher today than they were yesterday, you know, because the truck comes in twice a week or whatever. So there's nothing, you know, that says you can't stock up ahead of time and, you know, plan ahead a little bit. If you know you're not going to the store for 2 weeks, well... Think ahead.
Well, that then too goes to there's regional logistics that would occur, you know, and you're right, that would be one of them. You know, you have a 3 to 4 month winter that's going to shut you down, or at least you're not going to go off and to do things, and not a big deal, you know, if that's not what
I'm
you want to do, don't live there.
I was saying, you know, 150 years ago. But now, you would have enough at home that you can get, you know, you can eat and eat well for a couple extra weeks if you have to, if you can't get out to the store. It's not going to be something that's just going to, because like you said, you wouldn't have to go to work necessarily, depending on, you know, what you were doing for your 2 hours a day kind of thing.
If you work out at home.
Yeah. I think a lot of things involve a little forethought. You know, just like I have a friend who's very good about this, and her husband just doesn't understand why, you know, if she's running out and doing errands and things, she wants to know ahead of time. She doesn't want him in the car saying, oh, let's go over here, when it's someplace they've already been by. You know, she wants to do things in an orderly fashion. She'll make a circle, get everything done, and be back home. He would just have her flying all over town, back and forth, back and forth. And, you know, that's another thing, that it just takes a little thought ahead of time. And, yeah, you're going to save some gas. You're going to save a hell of a lot of time.
That is kind of a habit we do as a nation, too, where we sort of, everything's so accessible.
Well, I would say, why did we start doing that as a habit? If you guys have ever seen Who Killed the Electric Car, We had, you know, in the past we had buses that ran every 15 minutes. We had robust public transit. My grandmother often told me, you know, the bus, it was real, you could use the bus to actually do things because it was convenient. The trolley cars ran on electricity and not on gas, and that was reversed. That whole entire thing was reversed. We had electric cars way back when cars were first being, you know, introduced. But the oil barons weren't really going to benefit from that, so they worked out ways. Everything is about driving. Everything we do is about driving as much as possible. We went from electronic trolley cars to buses that use diesel and gas. And there was, you know, our cities got zoned and designed for driving. I've not had a car off and on in the past 10 years very acceptably. And one of the things that, or, you know, I just didn't have a car. So I've had to walk, you know, all kinds of places, and you realize that some of these strip malls and that kind of stuff, they're not built for a pedestrian. They're built for a driver. Just to get from the store across the parking lot to the bus stop is a considerable walk. And the bus stops are farther apart, and they're all, you know, they only pick up once an hour, and that was in Seattle.
Wow.
You know, that's a big city. So it's not designed for pedestrians.
No.
It's not. My friend from Germany said, you know, our towns are designed around pedestrians, around the convenience of pedestrians and public transit. Our country in the United States is built around the car culture. It's like a car culture.
Exactly. And it started
to expend as much gas as possible. And then the culture. Go ahead.
I was just going to say this started right after the Second World War, when people came home, and you know, that was when tract housing and suburbs started. And everybody had the house because they got the house on the GI Bill, whatever, and they had a car, and the woman stayed home, and then, you know, after a few decades, the woman was out working too. But they had that kind of a mentality, and, yeah, they did the suburbs, so you had to have a car because there was no way of getting, you know, now suburbs don't have a car, downtown area, but there's no public transportation as a rule, except like you were talking about maybe once an hour from 10 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon or something, you know, it's not like service. So
that is really weird to think about. There is no bus here in my town. There is a small bus service in the middle of town, but there is no bus service here. And where I grew up around Oakland, and one of the suburbs I lived at, Pittsburgh, oh, my God, I was an hour away from the ocean, and I would get my board when I was a kid and hop on the bus, get out to BART, the Barrier Rapid Transit, get on the train and go to the beach. And I could get an hour to an hour and a half away from my home for, like, $6. And you can't even do that in a car now, but it was I'm living in a town right now that you just described it to a T. It is designed around a car culture when it absolutely has the capabilities of being more.
Yeah.
I think I found
and
a new
and I would say
torch.
Now probably the West, Brett and I have talked about this a lot being in Texas when we were at the West Coast, is that now they've been gating off access to the beach and things like that by simply not allowing bus service. I was up in Seattle and I wanted to go visit a place I've been to many times, kind of on the shore of Puget Sound, and I could not get there by bus. You used to be able to get there by bus. I used to take my kids there all the time by bus. Now, when they did the redesign of the waterfront area, they made it so there's no bus stop down there anymore. You can only get there by car because they wanted to cut out the amount of people that were coming there, like on a sunny day, to go on the beach and be by the water. So the redesign of the area created a class distinction of who can access it if you have a car or not. So I walked there, by golly. I wanted to go. But I was really upset.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd be very upset.
There you go. That's another thing, class distinctions. Like, those things would have to go away, you know, like the McMansions and one-acre yards that are mowed so that everyone can see your one-acre yard of grass and your 4,000 square foot house for a family of four, you know, like all this excess.
Yeah, the 9-bedroom family of four.
Yeah.
I just never quite got that.
It was actually one of the factors in my divorce was that difference. I never understood it. My ex swore by it. And it was a status symbol that I couldn't even allow it to, like, be something and reasonably stand next to it. Like, it was an absolute issue for me that was a necessity. And so we would have to stress and work our asses off to pay for this thing when, honestly, I wanted an old house and revitalize it. And I'm like, if I get a bunch of land, I want to do something special with it because I don't need all this, you know? Where I ended up, it's funny, we both ended up in exactly where we were intending to go. She's got that now, she built one, and I got my 100-and-some-year-old house and 10 acres of food forest that I try and get people to come use and do things with, and blah, blah, blah. So we ended up there, you know? But it's just funny that, you know, my ex is an extremely smart woman. And a very capable woman. And it never registered. It's not like she was too dumb to get it.
It's a cultural difference, though. It is a consumer cultural thing. I mean, when you snap off the TV a year later, your culture, your personal culture is going to change. Your values are going to change.
Maybe that was it. Maybe it's that simple. I was like that before, but I grew up different. I grew up poor and loved my life. I didn't complain about it. I really made a lot out of what little I had, you know, because I did things differently than most people. I spent my time absolutely entertaining myself the whole time and always pursuing things. So I never really was upset that we would have groceries set on our porch or that, you know, I had to have a job before I was a teenager if I wanted anything. You know, I had to get a paper route so I could, you know, buy the things I needed. Or needed personally for entertainment, not needed to survive. But, you know, it was, I think I was very lucky to have the life I had. So, like, even before the TV inflicted on it, I always had a problem with it. And I think because of ingrained things I wanted out of life. But when the TV shut off, you're right, man, it was crazy, like, just what that did to my brain. What it did to my, you know, my way, the way my perception of what my time was that wasn't engaged in work. What was I doing, you know? Last night, I researched fairies during a thunderstorm for, like, 5 hours. And, you know, I'm like, I wanted to go to Candlelight because I was so into the mood. You know, like, anyone else would be like, you are an absolute dork. And I'm like, fiending over this book I found at the library that's roughly 100 years old, you know, by the dialect, and it was just so cool. I'm reading, like, Scandinavian lore on elves, you know, and, like, absolute nerding out here and getting into it. that's what I thrived on growing up. That's what I've always enjoyed. And, like, not many people do that. So kind of an anomaly
Kenny, I'm studying ancient mythology. I'm currently knee deep in a study of the Greek.
Oh, I know you are.
I do the same thing. I keep myself entertained, but you know, I'm just entertaining myself. There's not going to be anything on television that's going to be entertaining to me because the other aspect of it is the commercial's going to snap on every. It looks like every 5 minutes, and it goes for 10 minutes, I think, last time I watched the television. And they're just going to talk about stuff that I'm not going to even look at because I don't even want anymore because I've kind of pulled myself out of this consumer mindset.
Yes.
That, by the way, can we really afford this anymore as a society? Can we really afford consumerism? Is it sustainable? We built our economy on the concept of this unlimited growth and unlimited resources that we're grabbing up everywhere and not using very well and not being efficient with it. And our great-grandparents, went through the Depression time, I mean, they would, or the pioneering time, they would, if they were Native American, I mean, if they had a resource, they would utilize it to the nth degree. You know, every bit of that resource would be utilized and not just thrown away. We got to throw away culture.
And that's
not
sustainable. Very few people do that. Yeah, most people don't even think like, I mean, the era of somebody having a drawer full of rubber bands is gone, it's gone.
Yeah.
And we should bring it back because it's absolutely true, and it's just kind of, it's funny watching people discover, being broke, discovering all this stuff that they didn't know about, like I just, my favorite right now is all the building projects done out of pallets. Now, pallets are usually covered in God knows what. I'm building crap out of pallets, and I've got enough wood to build anything.
Yeah,
just because I got pallets, and I want to do it, And it's, but there's people that are, like, making furniture out of pallets in the city and bringing it in because they're exploring in one form or another, whether they know it or not, but they're exploring that resources and maxing them out. And it doesn't mean that the pallets, the chemicals in them can leach out or whatever. I care less. Right now, what I'm seeing, what I'm into promoting, I guess, is people exploring the unlimited resources that they do have and that they're not poor and that the world is full of everything you need. You just got to look. And most people don't look, It's just bizarre.
And sometimes with some of these things, you have to be a little creative. And I think that's one of the things that so much has been hammered out, pushed to the side, whatever, in a lot of public schools. Because they,
I was just thinking that.
Teaching your kids to think. You want them to be their own, operating a computer or a button at a factory. And you don't want them to think about anything. So we have to encourage more creativity. It's not that people don't have it, but it's got to be awakened.
It's been discouraged because all the, when I was a kid, we didn't have all the, branded toys that you have to have this type of thing. And everything's all there in the kit. We used to have to make our own stuff and use our imagination. Creativity, applied technology, applied human ingenuity is a really wasted resource right now because they want to give us our, they want to create that for us and make it a commodity that that kid has to have that particular toy or, they have to have that playset or those action figures and whatnot that are branded, and it has to be that particular thing. And that's, now the child is not engaging their imagination on their own or making their own toys or using their creativity themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned skids or pallets, whatever you want to call them. When I was a kid, I played with those and bricks. I had all kinds of rooms for my house. I never had a roof, but I had the walls and the floors and all this stuff and my cats. in baked doll clothes. My cats that I had when I was really little, they let me dress them. And so,
you have dolls, you have cats.
Those poor
really
cats.
Long-suffering cats.
Fine. Fine.
Living in brick ramshackle huts. How dare you? Making them wear the newest color that came out. You know, it's teal right now. It's a coffee heather fuchsia blend. Yeah. That's terrible.
At my parents' house, and you know, it was great. So I never lacked.
It's funny how we make a big deal out of that, and and yet everybody survived fine. And like I'm looking like right now, my kids are obsessed with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I was obsessed with them when they came out. I was just going into high school and. I was big into graphic novels, and that series came out, and then they had a TV show, and then there's toys, and I'm like, wow, this is cool, and then they died off. And then they had three different versions or generations of it that have come out in the last 15 years, and I look at bringing all the old ones back again, and, you know, and then you look at, like, Legos have now, they franchised into Marvel, and every movie, Harry Potter, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, you know, like everything's franchising and co-mingling. But the thing that scares me, and so growing up as an artist, I saw this. I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. I loved it. But it got in my way creatively because when I came up with storylines or when I went to draw, that's why I stopped playing, actually, was I could only think in the terms of pre-created denizens for my stories. My monsters always were tied to it. And I'm thinking, like, right now, nobody's given their damn brick and kittens, which is what we need to go, no joke, need to go back to. I know Joey is amazing. She's all into, like, getting these, like, wooden dollhouses and wooden kitchens and everything. It's not so realistic. It forces them to think, and it's real high quality stuff, like it's made by hand, you know, and it's really like someone put time into the toy and it lasts for damn ever. And what's cool is just the lemon wedge isn't really, it doesn't look like a lemon wedge, it symbolizes a lemon wedge, and it makes you, you know, like you use bricks to make walls. You didn't have walls, you know, that look like real walls. You made something and you symbolized it, and it gave you this confidence in your creativity and your ability to manifest ideas from nothing that we're losing, which is part of that big trap of money and everything else. The fact that we're getting sucked into that spell, and there's always a new twist to it, so we keep getting sucked in, you know? And
I'm so glad you used that word spell, because I've often talked about how the way that money kind of traverses up the chain is rich craft.
That
person, you see somebody with all those accoutrements of modern success, and that's a person who's adept in rich craft.
Yeah.
They figured out how to manipulate things in such a way, you know, and it's really ideas. Ultimately, it's ideas and thought, and they're capable of, you know, doing that. I'm not sure, you know, like what kind of Faustian deal you have to do to, you know, to activate on that. I'm not good at that. I'm not adept at rich.
I've been told I was allergic to money.
With blood, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, but that is, it is really the concept of money. You know, someone broke down the symbols on the dollar bill, and I should say the Federal Reserve note dollar bill, and the symbology there, it's really like a piece of paper. It's a talismanic piece of paper. It's a talisman.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And that's what it is. And you believe that piece of paper versus this, you know, open envelope over here, you know, that you scratched a recipe on the back of, that's not worth anything, except that the green thing with these symbols on it is. I mean, that's witchcraft, right?
That's it. It's absolutely, it's not just auto-suggestion, but it's tied to the whole concept of mind control. which is basic. That's the core of voodoo. You know, it's all about mental power play, and spells. That's the key to a spell. I mean, you get into any esoteric science, the key to a spell is to unlock or empower the universal laws, the basic functions of how things. Like if you get into, say, the law of attraction, we'll use that one, you know, that one everyone kind of knows about. But the core to it is operating in the now. And, like, one of the key components is with a spell is that you are to put out, basically, without screwing it up with language, you're to put out what you are desiring to have in your life. But you got to put it out there so that it does not affect the future or the past. It can only affect the now. And the key thing is your thoughts screw it up. So spells are enacted and designed so that you are to forget what you put out there so you can't even screw it up in thought. And then it comes to play. And that's what the dollar bill or most currencies do is they enact that will in you. And the guys that believe in the dollar, that's probably why I was considered allergic to money because I never believed in it. And so it never worked for me, and it never showed up, because I could find my way around without it, and I was okay with that, and I never really asked for it. And when I need it, it does show up when I'm really, like, it has a purpose. I can't just need it because I'm like, I want that book. I have to have a purpose for it, and it does show up.
Yeah.
But that's the way the spell works. Some people, they're trapped in that, and so it's always going to be there for them. It's going to come easy because they're caught in that web, and it's always going to be available for them, their kids, until it dies and runs out, which is what's kind of happening. And that's going to suck for them because they're not going to be ready to manipulate life without having that voodoo charm, you know, that talisman. It's kind of scary. I don't know.
It is. Yeah. When you put it like that, it's very scary.
Well, think of the bankers jumping off of, you know, roofs and bridges and out of windows and stuff now. And, you know, I imagine, you know, that dude in the boat Sunday. What's going to happen when the dollar, the Fed collapses and the dollar is worth nothing? How quick can he transfer his goods and services into the next monetary system, you know, or whatever? And the more crap you're attached to, the harder that transition will be, because you're going to get depressed because those things falsify your happiness.
I can actually tell you about the boat market because I lived on a boat, and the yachts are being, you know, these older boats are being traded around for, you know, $50, $100, going to auction for $200, $300. However, the market for fishing boats has gone way up, because if that guy would have stuck a fishing line out the back of it, he would have at least had it useful for that. So now the market is small aluminum boats with a kind of a smallish engine that will let you troll out there and get you some fish. That's now the hot market in boats.
Wow. Talk about a shrink in the world. That's actually a useful boat. You can get your dinner.
You can get your dinner. That fascinates me, because ever since I was a kid and found out that people actually lived on houseboats, I've just been like, oh, yeah. And I think either Seattle or someplace around Cincinnati probably has a big boat community. Yeah.
I loved it. When I went to go visit Karen, I stayed in the wheelhouse of that boat. I still talk about that. It was one of the high points of a very, very crappy week in my life.
Oh.
And,
I lived on boats for 6.5 years.
Okay.
It was really, really, really instructive on how your basics of life, because you had to pay attention to your sewage system, your electrical system, how you got water, how you heated water, how much electricity you used. I think it was been one of the best lessons of life systems and provisioning I've ever been through. And, you know, I kind of had to end it because, like, I always said you fight for your boat life and then you fight it every day. And I got to where that just got to be too much, particularly in the winter in the Northwest. But No, that's when I really learned, like, you know, what your footprint really is. You know, because if we plugged in too many appliances, we'd shut the boat off. The boat would, you know, the breaker would break. So we had to really be paying attention to our electric use. We had a water tank that had to be filled, so we had to pay attention to how much water we used. I learned to wash, you know, in cold water, dishes in cold water. I mean, it was an education in human systems and provisioning.
And in
minimalism, value very much.
Also, because minimalism is big and it's actually coming around.
Yeah, the tiny house movement in boat people are
yes.
common.
Yes, exactly. Right.
I'm obsessed with it. I get the tiny house blog. And I'm living vicariously through Gabe because he's trying to set himself up to do this. So, like, I have, my family's the size of an army, and the tiny house for us is a McMansion. So, you know, like, I'm just like, all right, Gabe, I'm going to help you do this. And I'm going to enjoy, you know, the creativity of this and study it, but there, I can't even pull it off anymore. I can't even pull backpacking anymore because I got to drag at least a few kids with me, which means that just changed my 2-pound tent and everything, you know. And
exactly.
I got rid of all that. It's gone. It's just I cannot do that anymore because I have to maintain more.
If you go, like,
I don't mind.
Shorter distances, and they carry a lot of their own stuff. One of the cool things I saw in an airport one time was this lady, and she had two little girls, and she was, you know, dragging her suitcase, and they each had their own small thing
nice.
On wheels. And I said something to her, and she said, yeah. She said, they're learning. Like, they've chose what they're going to bring, and they're pulling it. And, I mean,
wow.
they were 7 and 5 or something, and
wow.
I thought, this great, you know. So they were traveling light, but they were on their own. So, you know.
I like that.
Think about that.
Like that is kind of probably, you know, like it's funny how the popularity of things are tied to social and economic shifts. And mm-hmm. like when we were talking again, you know, about that snake eating its tail thing, like it's sort of during this class separation, the hot topics are everything we're talking about. Communities getting back together, people growing their own food, you know, shrinking their footprints down, and mainly because they're forced to. But then they're making the best of the situation and finding movements within it and drive and happiness because they're like...
People are doing it intentionally, too.
Yeah.
And not just not because they're forced to, but because this is the way they want to live. A simpler life. So I think
it's so needed. You know, that's the research for the general public. That's, you
yeah.
know, those are the explorers, you know, the guys out in the front with the machete and no compass, you know, paving
yeah,
the path.
Yeah.
And
we only have 2 minutes left. Ken?
Oh, shoot.
Do you want to mention next week's topic?
Yeah, next week, well, actually, Ruthann, you came up with it, so why don't you describe it better? It's because I don't even know how to word it yet other than it's going to be focused on women and societal placement of them and the lack of equality and respect, but I'm sure you probably got a better way to put it.
Well,
I'm still thinking about it.
But that's what it is, right. So we'll come up with a real title for it, but... It's a worldwide issue, and women are still third-class citizens. So we're going to address a little. There's so much to address in that, but we're going to address some.
Oh
of
my
the
God!
Issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll be very interesting. And
I'm excited for that.
Yeah. Well, recently this week, a court in India had ruled that a husband forcing himself on his wife, even though we would call it rape. The court said that it wasn't rape, that, you know, he could do what he wanted with her. So it
wow.
wasn't assault. It wasn't rape. It was just part of being married. So this
that's
is, yeah. So, you know, and countries are still, people in countries are still killing girl babies. And then we still have female genital mutilations and all this. So, I mean, there's a lot that we can talk about on this topic.
There's a lot to cover there. Tons. Yeah. And we're coming into the feminine age, too. So,
exactly.
Like, I almost wonder if that was, you know, just signs of what
exactly.
was. And
see, that's it. Oops. Okay, well, thank you so much. And Karen,
yeah.
just, but we thank you, Karen. Thanks, Ken. And we'll see you next
week.
All
right. Right on. I'll talk to you.
Okay.
Bye.
Good night.